TE Connectivity designs and develops precise products and solutions that connect and protect the flow of power and data to overcome challenges in industrial robotics. TE connectors, sensors, EMI filters, passive components, and relays help ensure the enormous quantities of data points from the robots and their manufacturing environment are gathered and routed at the highest possible speeds. With its innovative technology, experience, and creativity, you'll find it easy to achieve higher productivity and efficiency with better and reliable connectivity. Connect with TE Connectivity at TE.com to learn more. Welcome to episode 59 of the Robot Report podcast, which brings conversations with robotics innovators straight to you. I'm Steve Crow, editorial director of the Robot Report. Thanks, folks, as always, for tuning in. You can find us on all the major podcast platforms, Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, SoundCloud, anywhere you listen to podcasts. Please subscribe, leave us a rating, give us a review. Joining us live from Indianapolis this morning is the editor of our robotics group, Mr. Mike Oitzman. What's going on, man?
Hey, Steve, I feel like a field cub reporter today out getting ready to report the news. This is pretty exciting. Yeah.
Are there autonomous vehicles racing outside your window?
Well, I'm not quite at the track yet.
Yeah.
But I am. We're getting ready to head over this morning for get a little B-roll and some team interviews this morning.
That's awesome. It should be a great event. So we're looking forward to your reports when they come out later on. A big show this week, as always, Mike. You met up with Melanie Weiss at the AMR in Logistics Conference last week in Memphis to talk about the new products that Fetch and Zebra released earlier this week. So we'll play that interview in a little bit. But Mike, first, let's take a look at the news from this week. And as always, folks, we have you covered with the best news and analysis of the robotics industry with our network of robotics sites. You can see us at the Robot Report, Robotics Business Review, Mobile Robot Guide, and Collaborative Robotics Trends. Mike, let's start with some breaking news that came out early this morning, right before we really kind of started recording this. It's related to SoftBank. They're in talks, according to Reuters, to sell their French robotics business, and that's the unit that is responsible for the Pepper and Now robots. This has sort of been a tumultuous situation the last few months. According to Reuters, SoftBank is in talks with Germany's United Robotics Group. I've never heard of this group. Apparently, it's backed by Hahn. Hahn is a major industrial automation player in Germany. It's actually the company that acquired the IP from Rethink Robotics when Rethink Robotics shut down back in whatever it was, 2018, I think it was. And United Robotics Group, they also recently became the master distributor of the Now and Pepper robots for all of Europe. And that happened earlier this month. So,
you know, that's an interesting portfolio that they're building.
Yeah, right. I mean, you got industrial robots, hopefully. From all that I've heard, they've released a new Sawyer robot, Hahn has, and it's better than what Rethink Robotics built while it was based in Boston. But yeah, very, very opposite end of the spectrum, right, with these Now and Pepper robots. But of course, this could all change. You know, Reuters says the talks are ongoing. It's citing two unnamed sources who are familiar with the situation. According to Reuters, it's not clear if SoftBank will retain any sort of stake in the business. I feel like oftentimes SoftBank does. You know, when they sold Boston Dynamics to Hyundai earlier this year, when that was finalized, they maintained a small stake in Boston Dynamics. This is just a very interesting story to see how this all plays out. You know, Reuters, they also reported in June that SoftBank actually stopped production of Pepper units back in 2020. You know, that could always start back up again, right? If an acquiring company thought it was worth it and could figure that out on their own. But, you know, here's my addition to this story, Mike. You know, I've reached out to a couple of sources that I have at SoftBank Robotics Europe. You know, in particular, one source who has in the past been willing to talk to me openly, you know, doesn't want the name out there, but about the staff cuts, about some of the things that went wrong with the development of the Pepper robot, some of the culture clashes that have taken place between, you know, the Japanese folks at SoftBank and the European folks with SoftBank Robotics. But this person doesn't really seem to be willing to talk to me anymore. And in my experience, you know, when that happens, typically means that something big is in the works, right?
And, yeah, right.
You know, they're trying to explain some of the stuff that's going on with the, you know, the staff cuts and all that kind of stuff. But now, you know, being unwilling to talk even off the record and anonymously usually means that something is really going on. So, you know, we'll follow up. We'll see what's going on here, but certainly something worthwhile, I guess, to keep an eye on in the ever changing story of the Pepper robot. And one last interesting nugget from the Reuters report that came out this morning, and we'll obviously include a link to this in the show notes, but Reuters, you know, or SoftBank Robotics Europe a few months back, I think it was July, laid off a bunch of staff at the European division. Reuters is reporting that additional staff have quit because of low morale over there, right? So it's forcing SoftBank to try to quickly fill some of those core functions. But I also saw something earlier this week from a former SoftBank Robotics employee. He posted this on LinkedIn, and it just gives a little bit of insight into the lack or the poor collaboration that took place between SoftBank, the Japanese conglomerate, in this division over here in Europe. Is that the folks in Europe, so the robotics experts in Europe who were actually building this robot before SoftBank acquired it, they'd never wanted a screen to be on the chest of the Pepper robot, right? They never thought it should be there. It makes it look silly. And it's, you know, kind of defeats the whole purpose of it, right? But the Japanese folks insisted that that touchscreen be there, and obviously wasn't a great decision. The robotics folks didn't like it. So it just kind of gives you even that small little nugget. And I've talked to some other folks about some of the development challenges that hopefully we'll have a chance to write up in the near future, but just a little glimpse into the dysfunction at the company.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see where this goes. I think this is an interesting development, and who knows if Pepper's going to have a new life, new incarnation, and it's see where they take this in the next stage of its life and development.
Yeah, another story that dropped this week, Mike. Again, we plugged it off the top here. Fetch Robotics launching really three versions of an AMR that's built off one platform here. You had a chance to catch up with Melanie Weiss last week at the AMRs and Logistics Conference down in Memphis to get a sneak peek at some of these products. But really, as you put it in your piece yesterday on Mobile Robot Guide, it's really sort of the first fruit that's been bared from this acquisition of Fetch Robotics by Zebra Technologies for almost $300 million.
Right, and we'll get a chance to hear directly from Melanie in a bit, but the gist of it is that there's three new solutions. There's no new AMR. It's not that there's a new AMR, but they've built new solutions on top of their basic Fetch platform. And really, if I boil it down, as I did in the article, it's the solution that's coming straight at Locus Robotics, warehouse person, the goods solution. So basically, Fetch took their HMI shelf, which has been in the market now for about 3+ years, and stripped it down, rebuilt it, using, you know, basically input from Zebra and their experience on the warehouse, right? And they have this new Flex shelf. That's the primary product. And there's a great video that's in the article on Mobile Robot Guide. You can go watch the video to get a view of what this thing looks like. But it's got light bars on the side and uses light, pick to light, put to light interaction. It's got an integrated barcode scanner, which the HMI shelf did not have. That's another new feature for this. And of course, that uses Zebra scanners as well, of course. And then, of course, they have rewritten or added to their Fetch Core solution with this interaction release that provides better workflow interaction now from a person to goods standpoint. So that's really the core of the release, in addition to a bunch of new software features that Melanie discusses in the interview coming up in a bit.
It's amazing. You mentioned the similarities there visually, anyway, to Locus and their Locus bots. couple of people have reached out to me and said the same thing, including somebody who works at Stanley Innovation, which is where Waypoint Robotics spun out of, which was just acquired by Locus Robotics. So I think that's not a secret of, you know, how similar these things look. And, you know, Locus has had great success with their solution, right? So it's you know, we talk about this market really heating up, right? And now here are two big players, you know, coming, I don't know if coming at each other is really the right way to put it, but two very similar solutions.
Exactly. Yep.
We'll stick with logistics robotics here for a minute. A big week for AutoStore, the Norway-based developer of ASRS systems. They debuted on the Oslo Stock Exchange on Wednesday, so an IPO for AutoStore. The IPO, this isn't a staggering number. The IPO valued AutoStore at $12.4 billion with the B. It's the biggest IPO in Norway since 2001. So congrats to them. We have that story posted onto the Robot Report if you want to go get additional details about that. But, you know, the one thing I will say here is, Mike, we often talk about some of the crazy valuations for robotics companies. Again, you know, Fetch just sold for almost $300 million. Mm-hmm. I could be a little off on these numbers because it's coming off the top of my head, but I think it said when it was acquired by Zebra, I think the revenue or the sales in there was about, was it $10 million for Fetch on an annual basis? You know, AutoStore is upwards of $200 million last year in revenue. So, you know, again, does that equal a $12.4 billion valuation? I'm not sure. They said the IPO will help pay for some debt that they have on the books to make it more manageable for a public company. So I'm pretty high on these ASRS systems. It just seems like for some of these major companies, you know, the major e-commerce players that have the financial ability to get a new facility or, you know, rework an existing facility to fit one of these ASRS systems into the facility, it just seems like a great option.
Yeah, I think that's, I'm super bullish on AutoStore and the rest of the ASRS market. It's, you know, they are for major warehouses, you know, a good option.
We'll close out the news section of the week here, Mike. Do you want robots cooking your food, Mike?
Well, if that's the only choice that I have, as opposed to not having anybody cook my food with the labor market where it is.
Yeah, and I guess the chefs at these fast casual restaurants, I'm not sure how much expertise they're really adding, right? They're not probably really adding their own spin on things, but a couple food-related robotics items here. Miso Robotics, of course, they have the Flippy Burger cooking robot that we've seen over the years. We've had Buck Jordan on the podcast a couple of times here over the last year or so. They just came out with another version of the robot. They're calling it Flippy Wings, and it's designed to automate the frying of chicken wings. And I guess they're testing it right now with Buffalo Wild Wings. So, you know, interesting, I guess we'll see how that goes. They did have a big partnership with the Flippy robot with White Castle. I'm not really sure where that stands, but kind of a cool, you know, a new sort of market here for robots making headway into different types of fast casual restaurants.
Well, Steve, I gotta caution you, don't mix up chefs and line cooks. So the chefs would be insulted to say that they could be replaced with automation, but a line cook potentially could, right?
Yeah, no, good point by you. And then the last item here, Spice. You know, we actually had tried to have this company cater some of the food at the Robotics Summit a couple of years ago. I think we had some initial conversations with them, but a young startup that came out of MIT a few years ago, they built a food automation system and they actually opened a couple of restaurants, Mike, in the Boston area where they made different types of food bowls and they would automate the delivery of the ingredients and the shaking of these pots. Almost like stir fry pots that automated the cooking of these different.
It's fascinating to watch. You got to go watch the video.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And they came out with something, I think, 2 years ago called the Infinite Kitchen, which opened up the abilities to cook more recipes and deliver the ingredients differently. They were then acquired by Sweetgreen earlier this year, which is a large fast casual chain where they serve salads and other types of healthier food options, not like the Buffalo Wild Wings chicken wings, but they try to serve more healthy food options. They acquired Spice. So Spice actually closed down its original location in downtown Crossing. Today actually is the last day that restaurant is open. I've never been there. I don't know anyone that's been there. So I don't have any, knowledge of how the food is, how good it is. But obviously their automation is enabling Sweetgreen to come up with different options for food and safely, and enabling the human employees at Sweetgreen restaurants to focus on other tasks. Spice does have a restaurant 10 miles away from the downtown Crossing location in Harvard Square. They claim that it's going to remain open and that they have some exciting things in the works for that Harvard Square location. I don't really see how that makes sense. I mean, if you have Sweetgreen, maybe they turn it into a Sweetgreen location. I don't know. It doesn't really seem to, I'm not in the restaurant business, but it doesn't really seem to make sense to have one location.
Yeah.
Mike, let's get to the Melanie Weiss interview. Again, you had a chance to catch up with her at the AMR and Logistics Conference down in Memphis.
Right. And one thing worth noting with Melanie now, she was, of course, the CEO of Fetch Robotics. She is now moving into the role of CTO for Zebra Fetch, which I think we all know Melanie is a deeply technical, probably perfect role for her going forward to help influence where the technology goes. I asked her about features. This was prior to the press release. So I asked her about features of the new Fetch solutions, and we get pretty deep into a lot of the things that are new with this announcement. Also note for our listeners, it's a pretty informal conversation. I apologize for a bit of background chatter from other folks around us on the show floor. Try to do our best to edit some of that down. This is the first field recording that I've done, Steve, in the field. So here's the interview with Melanie.
Yeah, I think we're super excited about it. I think that a lot of our customers have been pushing us in this direction for quite some time. Unfortunately, though, when you look at it, we wanted to make sure that we understood what the customer needs were before diving right in. When you look at the HMI shelf that we originally designed, it was really meant to fit the needs of kind of manufacturing.
Yeah, right.
So that it, it could sit at a station or do a milk run or things like that. But it was never meant to be a fulfillment robot. Okay. And so when
maybe tell me what have you learned? How do you describe the difference between what that's doing versus this is doing and the workflows that it has to fulfill?
Yeah, so if you look at the HMI shelf, it's really meant to be front loaded. Okay. So like the robot pulls up to a station and the person interacts with it in a frontwards manner. It has bungee cords to hold whatever is in place, because if you look at the stuff that we had going on in manufacturing, everything was odd size. It could be, I don't know, we had everything from like rods and things like that, and like these shelves came out, but they were very fixed. Like, manufacturing processes are very well established, and they just stay that way, right?
Same thing every day, everything at 2 o'clock, it's doing same delivery.
And so, when you look at the fulfillment robot, we really approached it from their processes can be a little bit more agile, they have a different SKU mix on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that we could see from a lot of the feedback that we got, accuracy is extremely important. Mm-hmm. If you look at the pick-to-light system on the robot, it's really about driving that accuracy. Yep. So first we indicate that the robot's available for picking, and we actually can indicate the priority of the robot. So if you have multiple waves and say you have an SLA coming up and you want to get that wave done faster, you can change the priority of the wave. Hmm. And so the robots will actually flash a different color.
Make sure I got this right. You got two bots that show up on an aisle, right? And one maybe is there, you could indicate to the picker that this one needs to be filled first, even though this one's closer. You may say, well, I would do this one first because it's closer, but that one down the aisle is saying green or red or whatever.
It's a pink, like kind of a magenta, pink magenta color and like a blue. So blue is normal, but pink means high priority.
Okay, so the operator knows I need to, that's my focus
that's
right
my
now.
That's my first, right, yeah, that's my focus. Yeah. And so once you get to the robot and you log in, and so that's another thing that we did. So a lot of people have asked us, you know, why did you guys make it so that you have a physical wristband to log into the robot? And one of the things that we found is we actually found that a lot of our customers liked that because by having this low-cost wristband, you can register forklift drivers or forklifts, you can register anyone in the facility. And if they see a robot, they can log into it really quickly, do whatever the order is on the screen.
But there's accountability, it's a trace, right?
Yeah. But at the same time, like it doesn't always have to be these seven people or whatever. Hmm. And so we found that you know, we've had customers that have tried ours and the competitor's product and they really like the wristband activity because when it's they have other vendors have proximity based, but it can only be those people who are registered instead of kind of people who may end up passing the robot as part of their work, you know.
Is that a barcode thing or is it a dongle?
It's an NFC.
NFC, okay, yeah. Okay.
So then once you're logged into the robot will tell you which side of the aisle it's on, so with its lights. Mm-hmm. And then once you get the item and you scan it, it'll tell you what bin to put it in.
To put the light situation, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that when you look at it, it's actually very helpful for the customer and the associate. And so the other thing that we've built in is that all of that is pretty customizable. So through FetchCore, one of the things that we've spent a lot of time doing is making it possible to configure all of this very easily. You saw all the configuration options that we have. And so the pick-to-light is like configurable in that way. Then we also, when you look at the workflow itself, it can be tweaked quite a bit because before we did fulfillment, we had workflow builders. So we have the kind of block-like building of the workflow. So if you want to change the sounds that the robot's playing, if you want to change where it goes in the process, say you don't have a standard fulfillment process, maybe you have VAS, value-added service, in the middle of it, we can account for those processes part of our block lead type workflows. And I think that helps a lot because if you look at it, the way we built the software platform, we're able to work with any number of WMSs or WESs, and they basically come into the same top endpoint. And then underneath that, we're able to build the custom workflow with the tweaks that are required for the customer. And so we have a lot more flexibility in the types of workflows and the types of processes we can support. In terms of, say you have an overflow process, we can support that very simply out of the box with our product, as compared to some of the competitors who have one process. And either you're supporting that process or not.
Okay, I can see that.
Yeah, and then I guess you saw some of the other things that Barry showed you, probably that we have a really high payload capacity, 78 kilograms in terms of total payload.
How's that changed from this?
It's the same.
Okay, so same, but different than some of the competition.
Yeah, I mean, some of the competition has as little as 18 kilograms of payload, right? And that's a pretty big difference in terms of, like, our customers want an industrial product that can move a significant amount of weight. I mean, how many applications outside of apparel can you think of that is limited to 18 kilograms?
Yeah.
And so I think that's something to reflect on. Also, our top speed is much higher. So our top speed of the platform is 1.75 meters per second. We're actually working on increasing that to 2 meters per second. And some of that is really based on some of the navigation behaviors we can make in the system to make this system more deterministic, to make conflict resolution easier, things like that.
And so, and what else have you done on sort of the dynamic tracking in the fork truck and that sort of
those. So as part of this
that's coming out, that's also a part of this
announcement. That's part of this release. So over the last couple of years, we've been slowly adding new like machine learning capabilities into the platform. Mm-hmm. About 2 years ago, two and a half years ago, we worked on bringing into the market kind of semantic understanding of the environment. And so the first thing that we put in was robots know that other things are other robots. Mm-hmm. And I know people would say, well, they're your robots, you know where they're at, but there's latency in that. So we have Bluetooth communication between the robots, and we also have, so if you look at the robots, they have this retroreflective strip around it.
Yeah.
And it makes it easier for us to know that that's a robot.
You see that and you go, this is something special in the environment.
And so our big robots have it as well on the body of the robot so that mm-hmm. we can see that these are all our robots. Mm-hmm. And it's important, it enables you to drive faster.
Mm-hmm.
Because the one of the biggest problems with robots is they have a chance, they have a potential of running into each other because they're both in, like,
making a decision, left, right.
And that's the other thing that we worked on is, as part of our social behaviors, our robots actually deterministically go biasing to the right in the North Americas.
In country,
And then when you look at the forklift detection is something that is very important to us. And we had this aha moment specifically with order pickers, you know, where the person is on the platform and goes up and down.
Yeah.
So in a forklift, when a forklift driver is sitting in a forklift, the tines are going up and down, but they're still at like kind of groundish height.
Yeah.
So if a robot drives underneath the forklift tines,
or in the area,
but they can still see them.
Yeah.
But in an order picker, they're up and they can't see, and the robot might be below the platform.
They're coming down, and they expect people to. Their mindset is, I'm the priority here.
Yeah. And so a lot of what we've been focusing on is algorithms that help robots avoid those situations. Huh. And so we have a machine learning based detection capability for forklifts. And so we've been rolling this out. It's been pretty successful. And we see it as a big opportunity to add more behaviors that if it thinks something is a forklift, it'll now make that thing much bigger.
Mm. It'll give it much more respect in a sense. It's like,
and it'll put this imaginary area for where the tines are, even if it doesn't detect things there because the tines are way up in the air.
Yeah.
It's going to say, I'm sure that there's going to be something there.
I'm expecting something, whether I can see it or not.
Yeah.
I'm going to give it some respect. Okay.
And so we're working on different ML capabilities like that for different types of machinery and building that more and more into our software stack. So we have a social behavior stack that we're working on to basically take that semantic understanding and do something meaningful with it in the stack. I mean, the other thing that we've created are this notion of dynamic speed zones.
Mm-hmm.
So when we're in certain types of scenarios and it's unclear whether there's something there. So a good example of this is a robot is coming down the aisle and a person reaches over like this across the shelf to grab something.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The robot's vision can see it right now, but when it gets much closer, it can't see it.
Hmm.
And so
it's like a blind spot.
It's always a blind spot. But the good thing is the robot will still be able to see the legs, and so it's kind of projecting up that it expects to see a body.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is whether the arm is here. So what the robot will do is it'll slow down, and then it'll start beeping, saying, I'm going to move very slowly through this area.
Mm-hmm.
And so if there is any kind of, you know, concern about the robot hitting someone, the robot will be going at the speed specified by the safety standard that's considered slow enough for a person to get out of the way. But I think that's one of the things that's hard to explain to people is, like, we've built a software stack that is pretty specific for environments with trained people.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things that we've been working very hard with customers to understand, that they need to get their mind off of cost and focus on ROI.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you always have this notion that it costs $1,000 or $100, then you'll never get to finding out whether it financially makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And many of our customers have return on investment in the 11 to 18 month time frame. Mm-hmm. And they just have to change their frame of mind. It's like what I was talking about earlier with RAS. RAS is more than just a way for companies to make money. Mm-hmm. It can be a way to technology proof your company, because most RAS models offer the opportunity to extend the contract and upgrade the hardware. Mm-hmm. Most RAS models offer 24 support. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is if you look at it long term, it's a green model. And green is becoming pretty important from a climate change and social responsibility point of view. And RAS leans into that model, because RAS doesn't guarantee a brand new robot, it guarantees a working robot.
Exactly. And I hadn't thought about that angle, but I like what you just said. And I guess the last question, and I asked him, but I'll ask your opinion, is what in all of this has been influenced by the Zebra acquisition and your collaborative partnership with them now going forward in terms of what you're doing in logistics with this new technology?
I think a lot of this journey with Zebra started 2 years ago when we got investment from them. I don't know if you noticed, but over the last 2 years, we've been expanding our cloud robotics platform
to encompass
more industrial technology, mm-hmm. hand scanners, tablets. Yeah. And so a lot of where we're going now is with Zebra, we can bring in a lot more of that device integration into the platform from a kind of on-demand, out-of-the-box workflow perspective. Okay. And then they also have been working on Fulfillment Edge and basically bringing that middle WES layer, in conjunction with the FetchCore platform, opens us up to a lot of that opportunity of being able to work with all the different vendors very easily out of the box. So it's kind of a dual out of the box play. You know, how do you create workflows out of the box, whether they're, non-integrated processes, mm-hmm. all the way to highly integrated processes.
Okay. And I guess the economic part of that is just shortens the time to develop this all and get it deployed.
Yeah, I mean, well, someone once said, it's like, well, Melanie, I mean, I deployed your robot in 8 hours, but then it took me 3 weeks to get a conveyor. And so that happened like 3 or 4 years ago, and I was like, well, I guess we got to figure out how to get the conveyor.
Yeah.
it made a big difference because now you can deploy the robot in 8 hours and get the conveyor or the automated door up and working in that same eight hours.
Mike, it's time now for the technology tip of the week, brought to you by TE Connectivity. This week's tip explains how sensors and sensor infrastructure are transforming how robots operate in digital factories. Efficient digital factories are optimizing human-robot interactions. The robots are helping humans more easily perform cumbersome and time-consuming tasks. But as everybody listening to this podcast knows, using robots comes with many challenges, particularly around manufacturing processes that require accuracy and efficiency. These challenges are creating a greater need for sensor-equipped robots, robots that can quickly perform manufacturing tasks while also ensuring the safety of the humans who are working nearby. And this is where the sensors come into play, right? Controlling a robot's movements with sensors attached to and built into the robot really play a crucial role here. This provides the flexibility needed to accommodate variances in human activity. The sensors help ensure that robots can effectively detect the exact position of a manufactured object, which in turn informs the performance of the robot. Now, when creating this type of connection and detection system for robots, the goal is finding opportunities to improve the precision of the process and reduce processing time. Let's take a robotic gripper, for example. This could mean using a connectivity solution that allows the gripper to continuously turn in one direction. This also eliminates inefficient processes, such as having to stop the operation after each cycle so the gripper can turn back to its original starting position. The engineering challenge is configuring a robot that not only performs the necessary steps without failure and within the fast-paced and harsh environment of a modern factory, but also delivering reliable, continuous connectivity and offering high resistance to the daily wear and tear of production. That's why more robot tools like grippers are becoming electrically operated as opposed to the more conventional pneumatic systems. And digital factories are requiring greater levels of power to effectively operate these electric grippers, so managing the flow of power here is really key. And engineers on TE Connectivity's advanced technology team have developed a connection system that makes it possible to transfer energy and data over an air gap of several millimeters. These innovations in connector and sensor technology are helping industrial robots operate more reliably in any production environment, regardless of the extreme conditions that the production processes generate. So if you want to learn more about how TE Connectivity can help you, visit TE.com to learn more. All right, that's going to do it, Mike. Episode 59 of the Robot Report podcast. Thanks again to Melanie Weiss for taking the time there at the show last week to talk to you. So I got to ask before you go, how close do you plan on getting to the racetrack? I mean, are you going to keep some distance over the weekend from these people?
Well, that's to be seen. I'm not sure that they won't let, they're not going to let folks get too close other than from the spectator side behind the big fence. So even though we're media, we won't be down by the track. I think there's a lot of safety protocols in place at the IMS racetrack. But especially here with autonomous drivers, who knows what's going to happen, right?
And they're actually airing this race on Saturday, right? People who aren't going, where can they watch it?
AWS has sponsored a Twitch feed for this. So if you just go to the Indy Autonomous Challenge .com website, there will be information there on how you can watch it live on Saturday afternoon, the 23rd of October.
Yeah, that'll be fun to watch. I plan on watching a little bit of it. And I think it's funny. I pointed out to you earlier this week that there was another autonomous racing event that took place out in California on a much smaller scale. This was almost an informal meetup, I think is the best way to put it, of some folks who, I think Monarch Tractor was there, the folks at Tangram Vision, a startup in California that does sensor fusion and sensor integration. They actually outfitted a Mini Cooper with some LIDARs and turned that into an autonomous vehicle. And they're actually working on an article for us that we'll hopefully have next week about some of the challenges of outfitting a Mini Cooper with some sensors and turning it into an autonomous vehicle. So, you know.
Yeah, look, we will have a video. So I'm bringing a video crew. We'll have a video next week. We'll talk about it next week's show of the event. So interviews with the teams, interviews with some of the executives from the event, as well as some race highlights.
Yeah, that'll be fun. Looking forward to that, Mike. So again, folks, new episodes of the podcast come out each week. You can find us on all the major podcast platforms, Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, SoundCloud, Spotify, anywhere you listen to your podcast. Please subscribe, leave us a rating, give us a review. Mike, have a great time out there. On behalf of the entire crew, I'm Steve Crow. Thanks for listening, folks. We'll talk to you again next week.